The Organic Farming Research Foundation is honored to share a recent conversation we had with Chris Wilson, business manager and farmer at Wilson Organic Farms. This interview was created with funding from the United States Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS. In this interview, Chris talks with OFRF about the partnerships between the Wilson Family Farm and the NRCS. This collaboration helps the farm achieve several conservation goals and includes improvements in irrigation systems, increased cover cropping, and designing and installing grazing infrastructure for intensive grazing. Chris also offers advice to farmers who are thinking of working with their local NRCS and outlines the benefits of having local experts helping to develop plans for the farm. We hope you enjoy our conversation with Chris. To begin today, I was hoping you could just introduce yourself.
I'm Chris Wilson from Wilson Organic Farms, where we're located near Cuba City, Wisconsin, in the Driftless region of Wisconsin, which is the southwest corner of the state. We are an organic dairy farm, and my role on the farm is mainly as a business manager, and then seasonal work from there. Yeah, so we are a crop and dairy farm. We farm approximately 3,500 acres. And of that 3,500 acres, about 2,600 is row crops or crops. And about 900 acres is pasture. Of the 900 acres, we have approximately 250 acres for our milk cows that is intensively grazed. And we have the remainder for heifers and some beef cattle that we raise and finish. Some deep background on the acreage that we have. We row crop about 2,600 acres. It's divided out across about 8 or 9 different crops each year. The predominant ones that we grow are alfalfa grass forage mixes and corn, which is also used in different ways. We have corn silage, we do snaplage, we do corn for grain, and then the smaller crops or the lesser acres would be on the residual acres would be things like wheat, barley, soybeans, and sometimes different crops like yellow peas and things that are more food grade of that nature.
Can you tell us about how long you've been farming and how long the farm itself has been in existence?
Sure. So I would be the 7th generation on our farm. I graduated from college in 2007 and worked off the farm for about a decade and still do today, but really got back involved in the farm in about 2016, 2017, and have continued to become more and more involved in the daily operations there. Since then, the farm was first homesteaded in 1848 and has been passed down throughout my father's family side. And he took it over when his mom passed away in 1977. He's managed and had the farm really into the early 90s, 2000s. And then my extended family, my cousins, I have 3 first cousins that are highly involved in the farm and partnerships on the farm and have ownership in the farm, and their children are involved in operations. So today there's about 7 different families that work on the farm in different degrees and different facets and skills.
When did you become certified organic, and did you go through a transition process?
I was in school at the time in grade school into high school when we first started looking at transitioning in the early 90s or mid 90s. And we had some neighbors that were first transitioning to organic, and some of the first members of Organic Valley and selling milk to that co-op that was just emerging and starting to grow in the 90s. And one of our close neighbors that we did a lot of shared farming with, their equipment, shared ideas, resources, things of that nature, said, hey, you know, I'm going to give this a shot. So we kind of followed on. We tried it on about 40 acres. And then the next year, we just decided to go all in and transition all the acres that we had at the time, which was right around 1,000 total between cropping and pasture. So that started in 1996. And by 1999, we were fully transitioned on all the acres and certified organic on all the crop ground. And at that same time, we started transitioning the dairy herd. And we had January 2nd, 2000, we had our first load of milk picked up by Organic Valley.
Why is organic important to you?
I think the core of it is that it really reflects the way that we've approached farming, with the inclusion of livestock and really looking at it as a system that is utilizing resources in a, we'll say it like a circular motion, where we're using the livestock to fertilize the ground and using the crops from the ground to feed the livestock and using things like cover crops as factories for producing nitrogen and building organic matter in the soil and really feeding the life in that soil to do a lot of things that we need, such as putting roots down and moving minerals and resources around that ultimately feed the crops and feed the livestock. So I think that fundamental approach to organic farming and those first principles to organic farming really matched up with what our ethos for farming has been. And that made it a really simple or easy transition for us philosophically. For us, it was really that idea that a lot of the fundamentals and the ethos of organic farming aligned with things that we're already doing and things that we already believed in. And then with that, we got the premium for the crop. We were rewarded for those efforts. And we did have to make some changes. I think, the two hardest changes were probably taking herbicides out of, the cropping side and that weed management. So there was a lot of change on that side from a rotation standpoint and land management standpoint. That was really the major change. We didn't use a lot of inputs outside of those herbicides. So that was probably the main shift or tool that we had to kind of change out and use more mechanized approaches and rotations and things of that nature. And then we had concerns too about, losing some tools for antibiotics and livestock, but that ultimately ended up being a non-issue as we got into it. And really the animals, they built up better immune systems, and we have less problems today than we ever did when we had those tools.
Do you sell your products to the public? And if so, where? And can you tell us a little bit about the communities you serve?
So our main product is dairy. So we sell milk to Organic Valley, and they process it. They pick it up and process it right in the region, turn it into butter and cheese. And at times they'll take it to Minneapolis for putting into cartons and sold as whole milk or 2% milk in stores and distributed across the entire country. A lot of Organic Valley's milk goes into Stonyfield products and store brand products that ultimately came from our farm. So that's really the core of it. We also sell crops. So we do have produce extra crops that we sell. We raise hard red winter wheat that is sold to a mill just about 10 miles away from our farm that grinds it down and turns it into flour, which is sold also across the entire country, Meadowlark Organics. And they sell to bakeries and also to supermarkets in your, 1 pound flour and other sizes. So those are the two products that are out there. But then we sell corn, soybeans, and other crops to local farmers and egg farmers, other dairy farmers that are raising products. We also sell beef off the farm. So we sell them, as beef cattle, and they're processed. Many of them are processed locally and sold and distributed out to local buyers or people in Wisconsin and Illinois and Minnesota that buy beef products. So those are the main items.
You mentioned that Organic Valley is one of the main places that a lot of your milk goes to. And I was just curious if there's anything you'd like to share about how it works being part of a large cooperative like Organic Valley.
Organic Valley is where we ship all of our milk to, and they are a farmer-owned cooperative spread out across the country, involve nearly 1,600 different farms from coast to coast. And they are a very unique co-op in the sense that they really evolved from a group of farmers that wanted to farm differently, wanted to farm organically and with those principles and reach a consumer that valued those things. And a lot of those core principles of supporting small family farms, supporting farms that are producing food that is organic, and which at the time they established didn't have an organic label, but ultimately did get that organic label and policy and legislation in the 2000 Farm Bill to make that official. They're very unique in the sense that they today are still very much farmer driven, and it's a very democratic co-op in the sense that farmers really have a huge say in what's going on each year and the different things that are evolving in the marketplace and the changes that are made. And with that, obviously, you know, there's some challenges to having a lot of ideas and a big co-op that way, but to me, at the end of the day, big picture, it's a huge asset. There is so many passionate people and in the membership, and there's a lot of really awesome ideas that come from that and a lot of energy that gets put behind them. And they've been really successful. I mean, they've continued to grow and they continue to provide opportunity. I'm really proud of that.
What are some of the ways that you protect and enhance the soil on the farm?
I think the core things that we use for protecting soil health are making sure that we have a living root in the ground as many days of the year as possible, and providing that shielded cover to the ground to weather the elements that without it would cause erosion and soil loss. So those are the core things. How do we do that? Well, we use crop rotations that are really long and diversified, that have a lot of years of perennial crop production, such as alfalfa, grass mixtures. And we use some no-till practices within that rotation. And we strive to achieve continuous process where if we finish one crop, we're following that in with either a cover crop or the next cash crop right behind it. That ultimately creates a high percentage of days that have that living seed, that living root in the ground and working that soil. And then the last thing, we have the livestock, which are instrumental in processing a fertilizer that's reapplied to the ground. And we put a lot of effort into making sure that we're applying it in the areas that have the highest needs, and trying to really take ground and elevate it to its maximum potential. So we put a lot of detailed effort into that and our rotations to ultimately build that soil up over time, add organic matter, add fertility, add productivity.
Are there other conservation practices that you apply at the farm?
Yeah, I mean, I talked a lot about cropping. We intensively graze. So what that means is that we have areas in the farm in which we have milk cows that rotate through the pastures, diversified pastures, which have, you know, dozen or more different species of plants within each paddock that are, in many cases, have not been tilled in 2 or 3 decades. And we move the cattle daily during the grazing season. So they're in one spot, and the next day they are in a different spot. And we bunch them in that process of eating and grazing and trampling the ground does a lot of really beneficial things to the soil. And also it works in many ways with the natural ecosystem that's out there. And you have all kinds of different eco benefits to it, whether it's the insects or the wildlife that are participating in that ecosystem. It's really incredible to see. And then on top of that, you have the eco benefits of, especially in those systems, but also within our cropping system, where you have perennials and really cover crops and different things that are grabbing rainfall and filtering it. It's incredible to see the differences in how that soil can absorb rainfall when it does come, and then weather long periods without rainfall and really still stay productive.
Have you utilized any programs from the USDA National Resources Conservation Services?
We've used EQIP and CSP in different forms and different programs. We had started CSP, and I can't remember exactly when the first farm bill that was included in, but we participated in that. We've done different things like the cropping rotation and participated in things like cutting hay at certain times of, not cutting at certain times of day and things like that to protect in our area, you know, skunks and deer and things of that nature that are in it at those times of day or sitting down in it. And trying to really protect that wildlife. So that we participated in that CSP program there. We also participated in the cover cropping program in the CSP and are doing that currently. We have used EQIP programs in different forms. The main one we did was a intensive grazing EQIP program where we had funding to install better cow lanes in our grazing paddocks and upgrade fences that were in many cases 30, 40 years old. And then also transition from what we were doing before, which was more large paddock grazing for longer periods of time, to that intensive grazing practice where they're on it for a day and then they don't come back to that spot for up to 30 days. And it was part of a Wisconsin initiative, well, also in many other states, but it's a honeybee pollinator grazing program. So those are the main programs that we participated in over the last 10 years or so that I can remember off the top of my head. But we're a pretty good partner with NRCS in our local county, and we do a lot of field days with them and really kind of share as much of our knowledge with the farming community that maybe hasn't used the NRCS programs as much, but are interested in them. We try to be that leader producer as much as we can for our local community of farmers.
Can you talk a little bit more about your experience actually navigating working with those programs, or maybe advice you would have for other farmers who are interested in utilizing NRCS programs?
So, advice for other producers that are looking at using NRCS programs and working with those USDA programs, my best advice would be to meet with your NRCS and local USDA conservation agents. And they're really, especially in our county, we've been blessed. We've had some really knowledgeable agents that are excited for doing conservation things and trying new things out in the county. So they've been a really good partner in just exploring ideas and really thinking about our land and what's specific to us, what might work and might not work, and really having those conversations. So my best advice is to really, reach out, ask questions, be a partner. Don't just be somebody that's going to take a recommendation and not necessarily make it your own. So look to shape it around what you're comfortable with and start small. Start in a program that you're maybe cover cropping on a few acres here and have the opportunity to expand it if it works well for you. If it doesn't, then you have that choice that it's limited on a few acres. But that's really what we did, and we've kind of blossomed and grown and expanded what we're doing with NRCS and different programs that they have.
If I'm correct, you've done kind of a lot of work through NRCS with the pasture infrastructure around fencing, the livestock pipelines, trails and walkways, and watering facilities. You mentioned a little bit about that, but there's more that you want to share about those programs or the kind of changes and impact that they had on your farm. That would be great to hear.
So, looking at the infrastructure programs that we participated in for our pasture, it was a cost share program. And what it did is it paid for a percentage of the cost of the infrastructure and installation of that grazing infrastructure. And examples of the grazing infrastructure that were cost shared were the fencing, which we put in 6-strand barbed wire fence on our perimeter of our entire pasture. And that was cost shared at approximately 50% in our case. And that was paying somebody to install it. So it really depends too on what you're doing. If you install it yourself, then you have that labor savings, but it is a per foot payment on fencing. Similar on the water infrastructure, we had water lines that were placed into service and put in underground within our pasture system that we could then tap into and get water where we need it to out to the cattle. And that was again cost shared at a per linear foot. And in our case, it paid for about 50 or 60% of the overall cost. And then lastly, the other really big one was our cow lanes. And that was cost shared on a per square foot of cow lane within parameters that were laid out by our NRCS an agent. And really, the other aspect of this that doesn't show up in the dollars and cents is just expertise that was brought to the table on laying that stuff out and thinking about it holistically. Our an RCS rep happened to be an expert in setting up water infrastructure. So he was really able to think about some of the detailed engineering questions around water pressure and how far you can make those runs and how much well pressure you needed and drop pressure and things of that nature to make sure that it could go up and down hills and valleys and still provide the number of gallons a minute of water that needed to come out into the tanks. So there's the upfront like cost share, but then also the expertise that's brought to the table and really made that project a resounding success for us.
You mentioned the honeybee pollinator initiative and how that ties in with the prescribed grazing that you're doing. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
So in that same project, we had a honeybee pollinator initiative. And what that was is that it was a program that the goal was to increase pollinator habitat on the landscape, in this case, the grazing landscape that was being used for farming purposes and grazing and harvesting that pasture by the cattle, but also trying to create an environment where pollinators had really a continuous access to things that they could forage for their needs. And with that there was a set of plants that needed to be planted or seeds that were a number of clovers that ultimately created a long season of flowers pollinating, blooming, and ultimately that, you know, that food for those pollinators and habitat for those pollinators from the start of the season to the end of the season. One of the requirements were that we had to only graze each section every 30 days. So there was a 30-day effectively waiting period to graze each section, which in an intensive grazing system is a core principle anyway, in which you want to give those pastures that long of a rest period, in many cases longer for us, where we're waiting as much as 40 or 45 days in the driest times of the hottest times of the year to really let that pasture reach its full potential before we let the cows back out on it anyway. So that was that honeybee initiative, and it's pretty incredible to see. I mean, I always tell people that come out to the farm, I mean, you get there in late April, early May, when the dandelions are blooming, all the way into the, you know, fall when the burdock plants are starting to bloom, and there's flowers, you know, you can find tons of flowers basically any day of the year in between there. And it's tons of bees, tons of pollinators. It's incredible.
The other NRCS program that I think you participated in is the pasture and cover cropping. And if you could just talk a little bit more about that program.
So switching gears to more of the cropping side, the cover cropping program is basically pretty straightforward. You sign up so many acres in which you are striving to get cover crops on each year. And you have a list of different types of cover crops that you can use and different criteria, but it's really all pretty straightforward and best practices. And for doing that, you get a cost share on the cover cropping for 5 years. So we started that in 2018. I think we have one more year left after this year. It's been super successful. We cover crop about three different times of the year. We do some frost seeding cover cropping, which will qualify as sort of a carryover into the next year that we frost seed into wheat. And then we also do some cover cropping after wheat. We take wheat off and we cover crop also in the fall behind any corn or soybean acres that will be in corn or soybeans the next year, and basically provide that cover crop into that May window when we terminate the cover crop and plant the cash crop.
Have you found that extreme changes in weather have impacted the ability to farm? And if so, what are the things that you've experienced?
Extreme weather is definitely becoming more and more of a challenge. I mean, weather is always inherent in a farming system. It's always a core challenge to any farming system. Extreme weather seems to be more prevalent, more pronounced. We had record rains in 2018, 2019 that were resulting in 5-6 inches of rain occurring every 3-4 days. And we had basically 2 or 3 weeks of that in which we accumulated almost 20 inches of rain in over a month. And that has a lot of impacts. But the biggest one that you see is just on that landscape, how much erosion do you have? How much soil loss do you have? And really, we were pretty proud of our system, the way it held up, in which there really was not any extensive erosion, mainly because you have all those perennials in the landscape that are creating of soil absorption, and also really longer term, creating a healthy soil that's more capable. We have a lot of organic matter in our soils that really acts as that sponge in the system. And that was really successful in those years. On the flip side, we've had 2 years now, 21, 22, in which we've had really limited rain, in which rains have been very, I would say, timely, but also scarce and far between. So we would get an inch of rain maybe every 3 to 4 weeks, and sometimes less. And we really had a system that's held up extremely well last 2 years in the face of that, and had a diversified cropping rotation that's been successful, really successful across those 2 years of drier conditions after having a couple of years of extremely wet conditions. So I think that the diversity in our organic operation is a huge asset, and not being completely tied to one crop or two crops, success for a successful year allows us to weather those ups and downs in extreme weather and violent weather, just variability in weather in general.
Are there other challenges that you experience as a farmer that are kind of specific to the region that you're in?
So we live in an area that has, I would say, more roaming ground, rolling hills, and not flat or relatively flat areas of cropland. And that presents challenges in the sense that you have more opportunity for water runoff and erosion, and also makes farming more challenging, especially looking at diversified operations that have to use contour stripping and crop rotation to really help reduce runoff and erosion in that system. So that's been a challenge, and also creates opportunity for us, because a lot of farming has not necessarily held to those principles. And I think that by using those core principles that we've used in our rotation and our contour stripping and different practices, we've been able to really make that ground successful and build that long-term success on it.
Do you feel that you experience any challenges as a farmer based on your age, experience level, race, ethnicity, or other identity factors?
Yeah, so I think when you look at challenges around race, gender, and different age, those different challenges, I think that for us, we've been really, you know, we've been in position as a family farm where we've been able to successfully transition across those generations and hand it down, which is something that we certainly don't take for granted, and we value and we appreciate that many others do not have that opportunity. And I think that that is one of the huge challenges in agriculture. Is the barrier to entry is so high that unless you have that natural advantage, it's extremely difficult to get into agriculture. And I think that as we've looked at our farm, we've looked at future generations on our farm, that's something that we really try to A, value and as a culture, but also really think forward, like, how do we make sure the next generation can be successful here? And everybody of the generation, next generation that would like to farm has that opportunity. And it's not just limited to one or two or whatever. It's anybody that's really, truly interested and passionate about farming has that opportunity. And I feel really good about that on our farm, but I do know that that is a huge area that agriculture has a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunity for improvement, and improving those opportunities for new ideas and new farmers to come in and hopefully get a chance to bring their ideas to the table and bring their skills to the table in food production and agriculture.
You've mentioned that you're the seventh generation, so your family has gone through transitioning from generation to generation, and you're planning for that to continue. I just wonder if there's anything you would want to share about succession planning or transition planning, how your family has approached it, if there's resources you've found that have been helpful for that you could suggest for farmers who are approaching that kind of transition.
So looking at programs that might be out there, or just resources that might be out there to look at generational transfer and farm management transfer, it is an extremely challenging area to navigate. There's a lot of different variables that are unique to each farm. I would say that there's not necessarily, you know, one key resource that can answer all of them. It's really kind of, in our case, working with my aunt, who's a tax accountant, and using those family resources that we've had, and my degree in finance and economics has been useful in a lot of that discussion, and really thinking about creating the right incentives for everybody and creating, you know, as much of a fair playing field for everybody that would like to farm in the next generation, and also making sure that the current and the prior generation that's still living has an equitable, you know, retirement, has an equitable living. Those are all really, really hard questions to ask. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you have a successful operation and you have a pie that can be, you know, is big enough, then that obviously can take a lot of pressure out of some of those more challenging decisions, and really allow you to really focus on what the most efficient transition is versus, you know, maybe some other choices that are out there. So I think it really comes down to really your unique situation. And I don't know that we've used much from like a public resource standpoint. A lot of it's been more things that we've sought out and hired expertise and consultants and used family expertise to really answer a lot of those questions.
Can you talk more about the field days that you do with NRCS or any other community outreach events that you do on the farm?
So we do usually about one field day a year. And it doesn't necessarily with NRCS, but a lot of times we are working either with NRCS and or in our state, we have an extension agent, which is an agent that works for the state university system effectively, and is focuses on agricultural outreach, and then Organic Valley, as well as directly with the universities. So there's about five or six different players that we participate in, and a lot of them have a similar focus in natural resource management and organic farming. So that a lot of times it will vary year to year, and we try to keep the topic somewhat fresh. But we will have, for example, this year we had a field day in which we had really within the organic network, a community of farmers and that network out to our farm to look at organic cropping systems. And then we also this year had a second one about 3 weeks later in which we were focused on water resource management and really looking at how to use the landscape as to manage our water resources and make sure that we have clean water and clean aquifers, clean streams, not as many lakes in our area, but certainly downstream from us, you know, all of our tributaries run into the Mississippi and downstream from there. So having that water management, which was a partnership again with, in that case, with our extension agent and also our local group in the county that works with the state, it's called Lafayette Agricultural Stewardship Association, LASA, and Farmers for Sustainable Agriculture are two groups that are working. And that last one being a partnership with the Dairy Business Association in Wisconsin. So a lot of really partnerships and really trying to focus on a lot of things that I talked about throughout this interview, of just, you know, those practices and what we've learned over the years doing them. And then a lot of times we learn things ourselves when we bring, you know, people to our farm. And I personally go to two or three field days a year on different things. So I really enjoy going to them. I enjoy hosting them. And last year we had one on grazing, so it was really just focused on that. So again, it changes year to year, and those partnerships shift a little bit, but all those core principles are aligned with a lot of things that NRCS is aligned with. We generally get pretty good attendance in our area. You know, we were hoping a lot of times to get, if we can get 40 or 50 different farmers and local community people there, then that to me is a really successful field day. This year, I think we had one that was close to 60 or 70, and the second one was maybe closer to 30 or 40. So I felt pretty good.
Thank you so much for sharing all that you have with us.
Thank you for letting me talk about our farm and organic farming.
OFRF would like to thank Chris Wilson and Wilson Organic Farms for sharing their story. Again, this interview was created with funding from the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. OFRF thanks the NRCS and other funders for their ongoing support. And thank you for listening.